From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When the Canadian sitcom Little Mosque on the Prairie premiered last week, it got the CBC's biggest audience in 10 years. It's about a group of Muslims in a small town who start a mosque in a church basement and are constantly getting misunderstood by their neighbors. The comedy also follows disagreements within the Muslim community. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with the show's creator, Zarqa Nawaz. Also, we talk with Dr. Mark Klein about the clinics he set up in Romania and several African countries to help HIV-infected children. He's president of the Baylor International Pediatric AIDS Initiative. And critic Milo Miles reviews Last Man Standing, the new studio recording by Jerry Lee Lewis. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A new sitcom called Little Mosque on the Prairie premiered last week in Canada on CBC television and was a big hit. The show follows a group of Muslims in a small Canadian town called Mercy who have rented space in an Anglican church for their mosque. The comedy surrounds the constant misunderstandings that town residents have about Muslims in the mosque, but there's plenty of comic misunderstandings between the Muslims, too, because of generational differences and the differences between Arab, Black African, and white members of the mosque. My guest is the creator of the show, Zarqa Nawaz. It's loosely based on her experiences when she moved from Toronto to Regina in Saskatchewan. Nawaz also directed a documentary called Me and the Mosque about women who objected to newly created partitions in their mosques, dividing women from men. In the opening episode of Little Mosque on the Prairie, a new young imam from Toronto is coming to replace the mosque's more old-school imam, who was originally from Pakistan. The young imam is online at the airport, talking on his cell phone to his mother. A woman standing next to him overhears his end of the conversation. Misinterpreting what he's saying and suspecting he's a terrorist, she reports him to the authorities. Here's the scene.
Mom, stop it with the guilt. No, don't put Dad on. I've been planning this for months. It's not like I dropped a bomb on him. No, if Dad thinks it's suicide, so be it. This is Allah's plan for me.
Oh, my.
Now, I'm not throwing my life away. I'm moving to the prairies. To run a mosque?
Step away from the bag. You're not going to paradise today.
Excuse me, what is going on? You must have the wrong person. What? Those are my back.
That's a scene from the new Canadian sitcom, Little Mosque on the Prairie. Zarqa Nawaz, was that scene controversial?
You know, when we wrote it, we didn't think it was going to be controversial. And for, you know, for the most part, it hasn't been. But I have gotten some feedback from some reporters who felt that, you know, was it too sensitive of an issue to make a joke of? And I thought, you know, it was really interesting to me because I thought, you know, I had to be really careful when it came to Muslim issues and not offending sensibilities. But there are sensibilities even around 9/11 that one has to sort of respect and to take into consideration. So I did find that interesting that I got a few phone calls where people wanted to know, you know, did I think I had crossed a line by making fun of, you know, being a potential terrorist in an airport and getting arrested? So, yeah, it was really interesting to me when I took those calls.
Was part of the problem, as it was perceived, that you were taking too lightly security concerns?
That you know, what had happened at 9/11 was a very serious thing for the Americans, and that things that happened in the airport are not things to be trifled with or to make jokes about. You know, it was almost like talking to Muslims about, you know, a Muslim joke in this series. When I listened to, you know, to some people, and I was like, wow, that's, you know, that's interesting to me. I never realize that I, you know, that there would be some sensitivities around those issues too. So, you know, to me, you have to be careful, you know, not to offend both groups.
Well, let's take a subsequent scene after he is detained at the airport because somebody thinks that he might be a terrorist. He's interrogated in a room at the airport. Let me play that scene.
What's the charge? Flying while Muslim?
No, that's not the charge.
I was joking. Muslims around the world are known for their sense of humor.
I did not know that.
That was another joke.
Oh, whoa. What is that? Some kind of signal?
No. That's because you didn't get the...
You lived for over a year in Afghanistan.
I was volunteering with a development agency.
Why did you leave your father's law firm?
While I was in Egypt doing my Islamic studies, I found my true calling.
Explosives?
Yeah, explosives. Look, I am going to the town of Mercy to work as an imam. You know, like a priest? Hold on, I can prove it.
Hey.
I have the ad that I answered for the job. You can call the mosque if you like. If the story doesn't check out, you can deport me to Syria.
Hey, you do not get to choose which country we deport you to.
It's a scene from Little Mosque on the Prairie, and as we could hear, both the people doing the interrogating and the imam who's being interrogated are completely misunderstanding each other every step of the way.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of response did you get to that scene?
Well, it's interesting. That scene was actually inspired by the Maher Arar case in Canada. I don't know if you know about that case, but a Canadian citizen who was on his way back home, he had been away on vacation and he had to travel through New York to come back home, was arrested by American authorities and, in collusion with the Canadian authorities, was deported to Syria, where he was imprisoned and tortured for 1 year. And, you know, this man was completely innocent. And eventually he was exonerated, you know, he was returned back to Canada because of the efforts of his wife. And, you know, it was a huge, huge issue in Canada. How could we have allowed this to happen to one of our own, that we would, you know, have allowed these sort of stereotypes to cloud our judgment, that we would have sent a man that was innocent of these charges to, you know, to a country, you know, to be tortured. And so to me, you know, that was saying something that I felt I had to comment about. And so I wrote, you know, we wrote this scene together, myself and the writers, about, you know, being interrogated, you know, by a Canadian police officer. And, you know, and some people felt that maybe, you know, that scene, you know, took the issue too far. But, you know, I mean, there were different responses. You know, some people thought it was absolutely hilarious and loved it because it made the point absolutely as it should have. You know, and other people felt that, you know, did I go too far with that scene? So it was interesting to me how people responded, because it was a very, you know, politically sensitive scene, because, you know, you're actually talking about something that had happened to someone and it affected someone's life. And, you know, to me, that's the only way for me to deal with it, is through a comedic take on it, so that people can understand how serious it was for one person.
Now, in the second episode of Little Mosque on the Prairie, which I have not yet seen, the older imam, who's from Pakistan, wants to erect a barrier in the mosque to separate the women from the men.
Right.
Now, you actually made a documentary called Me and the Mosque about how more and more mosques in Canada have been erecting partitions between the men and the women, and that even happened in your mosque. Would you describe the change in your mosque and how that affected your experience of praying there?
Well, when I first came to Regina, women prayed behind the men, and there was no issue about that. You know, nobody even questioned it. But as our community started to grow, and we started getting more conservative immigrants coming to our community, there, you know, people started talking about how this wasn't really Islamic, it wasn't really appropriate, women shouldn't really be seen by the men. And it's, you know, I at first was like, okay, you know, we can fight this. This isn't really going to really affect us in any way, except that the voices started getting louder and louder. And at one point, I think we had a visiting imam from Saudi Arabia, you know, which is a very conservative country from an Islamic point of view, come down and say publicly that what we were doing was wrong. And this sort of emboldened the more conservative members of our community. And one day, you know, I came to the mosque and there's this shower-like curtain hanging where the women are praying, and we're expected to pray behind it. And that's when the problem started. You know, some of the women wanted to show that we weren't going to accept this decision, and so we prayed in front of it to show that it was unacceptable to us. You know, and I admit that there were some women who preferred it and wanted a more private space, so they prayed behind it. But I felt that, you know, it wasn't fair that it was a unilateral decision where everyone had to pray behind it, and that there should be some accommodation for women who wanted to pray, you know, in front of it without a barrier between them and the khatib, the leader of the prayer.
What kind of explanation did your imam give you about why there was suddenly a barrier between the men and the women?
The explanation is always like, well, it's just a more Islamic thing. You know, women don't dress properly anymore. Men are more distracted. We're in the West. Things are more loose and laxed, and we've got to tighten things up. And, you know, because they can't really defend it from theology, because, you know, there was never a barrier during the time of the Prophet. You know, men and women interacted freely with each other. There was a much more normal behavior. Like, I read stories of the time of the Prophet, and women, you know, used to speak up, used to ask men questions, used to ask, you know, if they couldn't hear the Prophet, they'd ask the men to repeat it. They would challenge each other. But there was this normalcy between them. You know, they still preserved their modesty, but there was more of an interaction between them, which I feel has disappeared now from many aspects of the Muslim culture.
Now, let's talk about the casting. Did you want all the actors who play Muslims to be Muslims? Did you care?
No, I didn't care. I wanted the best actors we can find in the country, because ultimately that's best for the show. You know, because there's no point in getting Muslim actors and then having really bad acting and nobody watching it, and then your ratings go down the tubes and then you're canceled. So it's best for me and the show that we got the best actors we could possibly get. And, you know, if they happen to be Muslim, that was great. I mean, unfortunately, you know, acting is not a career that most Muslims go into because of, you know, some of the limitations that would have to happen. You know, a lot of if a Muslim woman, you know, wore a headscarf, she wouldn't be willing to take it off. Or, you know, if a man was quite devout, he wouldn't, you know, want to be touching members of the opposite sex or having sex scenes. So, you know, it becomes very difficult for a lot of Muslim actors to go into the entertainment business. So we were lucky that the best actor that we chose to play Ammar Rashid, the new imam, turned out to be Muslim in real life. And, you know, with a good solid base of religious knowledge and the ability to recite Arabic, which was a huge advantage to us.
This is, from what I've read, this is like the first Muslim sitcom in mm-hmm. North America.
Yeah, as far as I know.
Are you the only Muslim on the writing staff?
I am. We don't have, like I mentioned before, Muslims going into the entertainment field, they're very few and far in between. So I don't think we really have any or maybe extremely few Muslim writers in Canada. And because we are Canadian and we protect our cultural product, we have certain rules, which means we don't use writers from other countries. Like in the U.S., there's no rules like that. You know, you don't have to protect your cultural product because you have global dominance.
We're king.
You are. And we compete
against
you.
We rule the world in pop culture.
You absolutely do. And the only way to protect, you know, I mean, if we didn't have those rules, I think everyone would like automatically cast Brad Pitt in every film they could if they're going to get Canadian funding. So our rules are we use, you know, Canadian actors, Canadian writing teams to keep the cultural product Canadian. And so what that does, you know, also means that it's difficult to find Muslim writers. But in a way, I think that it's an advantage to us because bringing in other writers from different faith communities opens up the writing and makes sure that it's not insular, that people can't relate to the subject matter, that, you know, we do tell stories that have to do with Muslim communities, but it's not written in such a way that you would have to belong to that community to understand, because, you know, ultimately this show is going to be seen by the non-Muslim community in order for it to survive and get the ratings to carry on. So we have to make it as universal and accessible as possible.
My guest is Zarqa Nawaz, the creator of the new Canadian sitcom Little Mosque on the Prairie. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Zarqa Nawaz, the creator of the new Canadian sitcom, Little Mosque on the Prairie. Now, I know you wear a headscarf, and I'm wondering if you think that that is a sign of the inequality of women.
I don't think so. I mean, to me, it's the choice of a woman to decide how she wants to wear, what she wants to wear, and her level of modesty. And to me, I prefer a certain level of modesty. And I think, you know, if you look at the society, you'll have people like Britney Spears or Paris Hilton. And if they just, you know, if they choose not to wear an underwear and flash people when they get into cars, I mean, that's acceptable in the society. So if that's acceptable, then if a woman wants to cover her hair because she believes in, you know, in a higher degree of modesty, then that should be acceptable too. To me, the problem comes in when men decide that this is how you're going to dress and you have no choice and we will force you to dress this way. That's the point where I think it starts to become problematic. Because I think, you know, you can sexualize a woman in two ways. One is to objectify a woman sexually in two ways. One is to take off her clothes completely, and one is to completely enshroud her in, you know, in a veil that's like you head to foot where you can't see anything. I think those are two extreme ends of the same thing, ultimately. And I feel like the middle is where I want to be, where it's just, you know, where you're comfortable dressing modestly. You know, I think it's a woman's right to decide if she wants to wear the headscarf. I know that there are Muslims who believe it's mandatory, and that's fine, but I don't think it's right to impose that upon a woman.
How old were you when you started wearing the hijab?
I was 13. I was starting high school.
And was it your idea to wear it or your mother?
Yeah, very much my idea. My mom didn't wear it. I just felt more connected to my faith by wearing it. And I just felt a stronger sense of, I got a stronger sense of identity as a Muslim woman wearing it. And I just, you know, it just made me feel better about who I was as a Muslim, because people recognized me. People knew where I was coming from, what I had to say, what my beliefs were. And I've always felt very empowered by it.
Do you have any daughters?
I have two daughters and two sons, so equal.
Do your daughters wear the headscarf?
No, I want them to decide later in their lives. They're only 10 and 12. And I feel that that's a decision that they have to make when they're older. I want them to sort of, you know, enjoy themselves as, you know, young women growing up. And these are, and I don't, you know, to me, modesty goes beyond just the headscarf. I think for me, I'm more concerned with sort of neck down. I'd rather, you know, they learn to dress modestly as women, because, you know, I think both men and women need to dress modestly, just, you know, just as themselves. And I would, the same rules I have for my daughters, I will have for my sons. And if they choose to wear the headscarf, that will be up to them. But I'd rather they wait until they're much older.
Since you wear a headscarf, where do you find beautiful ones to wear?
It's a good question, because living in Regina, it's a huge challenge finding really good headscarves. So I make sure that when I'm in Toronto, I scour the Islamic stores to find the most beautiful ones I can find. And then I try to go to the biggest Islamic convention in North America, which is the Islamic Society of North America in Chicago at Labor Day weekend. So I go there every year. And I do a giant shopping trip where I get as many scarves as I can possibly cram into my suitcase, and customs will let me come across without finding me. Because there's a limit, you know. Uh-huh. And I wish they would change that limit.
Now, I want to play something from early in Little Mosque on the Prairie, in which the older imam, the imam who's from Pakistan, is preaching at the mosque.
As Muslims, we must realize the enemy is not only out there. The enemy is much closer than you think. The enemy is in your kitchen.
Maybe while the enemy's in there, he could do the dishes.
He may have a point.
Dad, Bobber never has a point.
My point is this. Wine gums, rye bread, liquor-ish. Western traps designed to seduce Muslims to drink alcohol.
His sermons are going to drive me to drink alcohol.
Patience, daughter. Even it's worse. His last sermon. The new mom will be on his way very soon.
American Idol. Canadian Idol. I say all idols must be smashed. Desperate housewives. Why should they be desperate when they're only performing their natural womanly duties?
It's a scene from Little Mosque on the Prairie, and my guest is the creator of the show, Zarkar Nawaz. Have you ever been in a mosque with an imam who so completely misunderstood popular culture?
Well, it was a bit of an exaggeration, but yes, when I, you know, was growing up in a mosque, I did have an Islamic teacher who told us, you know, we shouldn't be drinking root beer and, you know, hamburgers, and that the, you know, these words were a little bit, embedded in the culture, and I remember, you know, for years, as you know, as a kid growing up in Canada, I wasn't allowed to drink root beer because my parents were genuinely confused by what it really was. So you know, it's a bit of an exaggeration, but there's a grain of truth to it too, because it was inspired by my Islamic school teacher when I was a teenager. So I'm really hoping he's not recognizing.
No, well, you just gave it away.
Yeah. I'm hoping that he's retired and, you know, peacefully in the Barbados or something.
So did the kids laugh at him when he got it wrong like that?
At the time when I was growing up?
Yeah.
No, we took him quite seriously. Like, I mean, he was, you know, he was sort of, you know, we were much younger and he, you know, he was much older and he was saying, you know, things like hamburgers and, you know.
He thought hamburgers were made out of ham.
Well, yeah, he was like, you really have to be careful and look at the words and, you know, what are the, you know, what, why, you know, why are these words there? And he was sort of warning us to be more careful about the ingredients and, you know, what the meaning of these words were, and were they sort of softening us to accept alcohol? And so, you know, I mean, I'm sure he meant well, I really do, but I think it was a great inspiration for that scene. And yeah, I think people in my community are a bit more careful when they talk to me now.
Oh, yeah. Well, is that happening, that people are afraid to see you around because they think they're going to end up on the show?
Yeah. I think people are sort of being a bit more careful because they're realizing that it's all good material for me.
But you do have a lifetime to draw on.
I do. And God knows there's enough stuff in the news that you can just continue to draw on stuff that happens in the headlines constantly about Muslims. And so, you know, it's great for me in terms of material. I seem to have no end of it.
Does anybody think that you're a traitor because, among other things, you're showing comic divisions within the Islamic community? You're not just showing, like, people from the outside who distrust Muslims and Muslims who are skeptical of the outside world. There's a lot of divisions within the community that you're talking about.
Yeah, I think that, I think overall, because I'm an organic part of the community that I'm representing, there's not that fear, because I still go back to the mosque. I'm, you know, the mosque is very much a part of my current life. And, you know, I have accountability to my people. Like, I can't, I'm not writing from someone far away who doesn't have to deal with the Muslim community. There's a lot of accountability for myself. I mean, I deal, you know, with my community on a daily basis. I can understand some people's fears, because there have been a lot of Muslims who, you know, quote unquote, have sold out their community to be able to sell a book, or, you know, get ahead in their career by, you know, bringing out divisions or making Muslims very angry and saying, see, this is how they react. This is the way they are. Whereas in my community, I think there is a sense that, you know, that's not what I'm out to do. I'm not out to further my career by selling out my community. What I'm trying to do is bring a better understanding between two communities that really, really need a chance to look at each other and laugh at each other and, you know, bridge the gaps of paranoia that exists right now. And that, you know, for every, you know, kooky Muslim I have in my show, I have an equally kooky non-Muslim. So sort of an equal opportunity show for all people.
If your sitcom gets picked up by an American broadcaster cable network, are there changes you think you'd have to make because there are some references that are so Canadian that Americans wouldn't get them?
Yeah, I mean, even when we're shooting it, we're doing alternatives to certain takes.
Oh.
So that if it does get picked up by an American broadcaster, there won't be that many changes. So we're conscious of that, which is why we haven't actually referenced where we are in the prairies. We just generally say we are in a town of mercy in the prairies. We don't actually reference the province of Saskatchewan. Because, you know, it could be in North Dakota easily.
Uh-huh,
as
I
well
see.
As so we don't actually say it's Saskatchewan. We're very clever that way. Sales are important.
Absolutely. Well, good luck and thank you so much.
Well, thanks for having me.
Zarka Nawaz created the Canadian sitcom Little Mosque on the Prairie. It premiered last week on the CBC. You can watch a scene on our website, freshair.npr.org. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Ovid's The Metamorphoses, in stores and online at bn.com. And from the California Endowment, working to improve the health and health care of California's diverse communities and celebrating 10 years of community health and partnership. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose, at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, treating children with HIV in several African countries and Romania, we talk with Dr. Mark Klein, president of the Baylor International Pediatric AIDS Initiative. And Milo Miles reviews the new recording by Jerry Lee Lewis and an impressive list of collaborators. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Dr. Mark Klein, has seen something he never thought he would, watching children with HIV live long enough to have children of their own. In addition to treating children in the U.S., Dr. Klein has started pediatric AIDS clinics in Romania and four African countries, Lesotho, Botswana, Malawi, and Swaziland. He's the president of the Baylor International Pediatric AIDS Initiative, which is now partnering with UNICEF and has become the biggest pediatric AIDS initiative in the world. Dr. Klein is also the head of retrovirology at Texas Children's Hospital. How has the prognosis for children with HIV changed?
Here in the United States, there has been a really remarkable change in the outlook for children with HIV with the advent of highly active antiretroviral therapy. These are combinations of antiretroviral drugs that can nearly totally suppress the ability of the virus to replicate within the body. And these therapies became available in the mid-1990s, and subsequently, children with HIV in the United States have lived long and really very healthy lives. But in the developing world, where access to drugs has been limited up until now, children continue to die at a very high rate. About 600,000 children died last year alone of HIV/AIDS globally.
Do most children with HIV get it from their mothers?
Well, they do, yes. Globally, more than 90% of the children with HIV have acquired the virus from their mothers. The virus can be passed across the placenta during pregnancy. It can be passed from mother to infant at the time of delivery because of exposure of the infant to maternal blood and vaginal and cervical secretions. And then it can be transmitted after birth through breastfeeding. And so those really are the three principal time points at which the virus can be transmitted from mother to baby.
And it must be hard in some places to convince mothers not to breastfeed their children.
It can be. In a number of settings around the globe, there really isn't a viable alternative to breastfeeding. Water is not safe for drinking. It often is contaminated. Breastfeeding, of course, is a protection against diarrhea and other potentially life-threatening infections. And formula is prohibitively expensive in very many poor settings around the world. And then in addition, across Africa, there's a certain stigma associated with formula feeding. Mothers are expected to breastfeed. And if the mother is not breastfeeding, the community may conclude that it is because she is HIV positive.
Your interest in international work with children who have HIV started in Romania in the 90s. How did you get there in the first place?
Well, I had been taking care of children with HIV in the United States from about 1987 on, and I had seen the transformation in the health of children with HIV here. And in February of 1996, I made a trip to Romania, and I visited a number of orphanages where there were hundreds of HIV-infected children wasting and dying of AIDS. And it had quite an impact on me. I came back to the United States knowing that I had to do something to help. At that point in my career, I thought I had seen everything. I really thought I knew everything there was to know about pediatric HIV, but I realized at that point that this disease was having a terrible impact on children in the poor countries. And so we started a program at Baylor that initially was focused on training doctors and nurses in Romania how to take care of children with HIV. And it subsequently grew into a care and treatment program for children with HIV in Romania. And from there, we expanded to Africa and to Latin America and then to Asia.
Why were so many children in Romania infected with HIV?
Romania is an interesting place. Fortunately, it's unique. There were thousands of children infected with HIV in Romania in the late 1980s because of certain medical practices that were prevalent at the time, in particular, the use and reuse of disposable needles and the injection of unscreened human blood for a variety of reasons, for stimulating the immunity of newborn infants, for promoting growth, for combating iron deficiency, anemia, and malnutrition. All of this was without any real scientific basis. But thousands of children became infected with the virus,
a lot of them were infected by doctors who were trying to help them by injecting blood?
Yes. So the epidemic in Romania really is a consequence of medical practices. It is what is termed nosocomial or hospital-acquired. And so most of these children actually acquired the infections in the hospitals or in some cases in orphanages. And many of them, at least 6,000 or 7,000, are still alive today. And, of course, as a consequence of time, they're adolescents and young adults.
What did you see on your first trip to Romania? What kind of conditions were the children with AIDS who you saw living in?
Well, the medical conditions of the children were just really stark. The children had open sores on their skin. They had terrible lesions in their mouths. They were wasted. Many of them literally were skin and bones. They had terrible chronic pneumonia and chronic diarrhea. These were the sickest children that I had ever seen in my life, and far more ill than any children with HIV I had ever seen in the United States. And it was so striking to me, I think, because, again, it came at a time when highly active antiretroviral therapy had restored American children to health. And it was such a striking contrast to see these children so ill without access to these life-saving drugs.
Do you still continue to make trips to Romania? And if so, can you tell us the story of one of the children who is maybe not a child anymore, whose story you've continued to follow?
Yeah, I do travel frequently to Romania. I was just there at Christmas time, and it really is remarkable to see the transformation. First, for the population as a whole in Constanza, the city where our center is located, the annual death rate for HIV-infected children dropped in 3 years from 13% per year to less than 1% per year. That's the difference between 109 deaths in a year and only 7 deaths. That obviously was a remarkable change. Children were living instead of dying. We saw a 90% reduction in hospitalizations, so that the pediatric ward at the infectious disease hospital, which in 2001 on any given day had an average of about 34 HIV-infected children hospitalized for various complications, that number dropped to 4 by 2003. But for the children individually, the transformation has been equally remarkable. These little wasted, stunted children, in some cases children who were 10 or 11 or 12 years old but looked like 3- and 4-year-old children, have grown tall and strong. Many of them are taller than I am today. They look perfectly healthy. Some have graduated high school. Many of them are in job training. Some of them are living independently. Many of them have married. We've had about 10 pregnancies and births of children from girls who are cared for in our clinic in the past year. Fortunately, none of the babies are infected. So these children that I think just about everyone thought would lead very short, painful lives and die young are actually living and not just surviving but thriving. And they can look forward to very full lives. And this is a consequence of good medical care and highly active antiretroviral therapy.
My guest is Dr. Mark Klein, head of the Baylor International Pediatric AIDS Initiative. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Mark Klein. He's chief of retrovirology at Texas Children's Hospital, and he's the president of the Baylor College of Medicine International Pediatric AIDS Initiative, and they have programs in several African countries. What are some of the big differences you've seen in dealing with AIDS in Africa versus dealing with AIDS in Romania?
In Romania, the epidemic was what the epidemiologists sometimes refer to is almost a closed cohort. It was a group of children who were infected at a particular point in time, and then they aged through infancy and into the school age years and ultimately into adolescence and now are becoming young adults. So even in 1996, when I began working in Romania, most of the children were 6, 7, 8 years old. In Africa, on the other hand, the children have been infected vertically, that is, from mother to infant, either during pregnancy or around the time of delivery or through breast milk. And that has been a continuous phenomenon over a period of years now. And most of the children who come to medical attention are rather young. Half are under 2 years of age. And so there are special challenges associated with treating very, very young children, particularly challenges to treating infants, getting the medications into the infants, determining the proper dosages of the medications, making certain that the medicines aren't producing any toxicity in an infant. All of that is a bit more complicated than the treatment of older children. The pace of the disease also in Africa is somewhat different. It's been observed that about half of African children with HIV die without treatment by the age of two, which means that you have really a limited window of opportunity to intervene with treatment. If you haven't identified the infant as being HIV positive and instituted therapy within the first 18 months or 24 months of life, it's very likely that that child will have died.
What are some of the biggest obstacles you've faced in setting up these pediatric AIDS clinics in African countries?
Well, the challenge has been that there really was no blueprint for it. And certainly early on when we got started, authorities and very knowledgeable people were questioning whether the kinds of treatment that were given to HIV-infected people in the United States ever would be practical or affordable for HIV-infected people in Africa and other poor parts of the world. And so it was difficult to overcome that sort of idea that it was futile, that basically people who were infected were just going to die and that there was nothing that could be done.
You know, the more clinics that you set up in Africa while also dealing with the pediatric program in the United States at Texas Children's Hospital, the more overwhelming it must seem. And I guess I'm wondering if it ever gets so overwhelming to see, like, so many children with HIV.
It can be. You know, the key, I think, is not to focus on the enormity of the problem, but on the individual stories and individual successes. And any big problem can be dissected down into a number of smaller, more manageable problems. And this is the way that I try to approach everything that we do. I think one of the reasons that life-saving treatment did not make its way to African children and other children living in the poor countries earlier on was that people just simply threw up their hands in despair. They said the program is too big, there is nothing we can do. But you have to make that first step. You have to start somewhere, and that's what we've done. You put a few dozen children on treatment, and then a few hundred, and a few thousand, you know, it's a life or death difference for those children who you have provided access to treatment. And but it really is a race against time. We have a limited window of opportunity here to roll out treatment to hundreds of thousands of children, to bring to scale treatment programs that to date really have just been established on kind of a pilot basis. And we have to work quickly or we will lose a generation of African children in particular.
Can you tell us about one of the children who you've treated for a long period of time, who you've watched grow up with HIV, and tell us how they've handled it?
Sure. Well, one patient who comes immediately to mind is a little girl who I first saw at about 2 years of age. She had been born to a crack-addicted mother, was infected with HIV at birth.
This was in America?
In America, yes, here in the United States, and was adopted at about 6 months of age by a family who knew her HIV status. She was a sickly infant and toddler. She had been hospitalized repeatedly, had failed to thrive, had repeated bouts of pneumonia and diarrhea. And the doctors who saw her initially had told her adoptive parents that it was unlikely she would survive to school age. But at about 2 years of age, she became one of the first American children to receive highly active antiretroviral therapy, and it had a dramatic effect in restoring her immune system to health. The level of virus in her blood dropped to below levels of detectability, and she literally has been completely healthy for the past 10 years with no detectable virus in her blood during that entire period of time. And over the past 10 years, she's grown into a beautiful young teenager who is a great student, who is an athlete, and who is thriving in every sense of the word. And this is really what we hope for every child with HIV. This is a real possibility. It is not fantasy to think that the children so ill today in Africa and around the world with HIV can be restored to health and can live long and very full lives. We're not talking about the difference between dying at 2 or 3 years of age or dying at 5 years of age. We're talking about the difference between dying at 2 or 3 years of age and living to be 40 or 50 or 60 years old.
Do you feel like you are capable of seeing an end to the AIDS epidemic?
I think we have a long way to go. I don't know realistically that this is something we will see anytime soon. We have to stem the flow of new infections, and that depends at this point in time on behavioral change and on the rollout for children in particular of programs to prevent mother-to-child transmission. And I don't see a great deal of progress on either of those fronts. A vaccine certainly is something a lot of people are working towards, but we may be a number of years away from an effective vaccine for prevention of HIV. So I don't know that it's realistic to think, at least in the foreseeable future, to think about an end to the HIV/AIDS epidemic.
Well, Dr. Klein, thank you very much for talking with us.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Mark Klein is the head of the Baylor International Pediatric AIDS Initiative, which is now partnering with UNICEF. He's also a professor of pediatrics at Baylor College of Medicine. Coming up, Milo Miles reviews Jerry Lee Lewis's new CD of duets. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Piano-pounding Jerry Lee Lewis is invariably cited as one of the founders of rock and roll, but since his last new release in 1996, he's kept as low a profile as a pop legend can. Now he has a fresh studio album, Last Man Standing, recorded during the last 5 years with an impressive cast of collaborators, including Mick Jagger, Keith Richards, B.B. King, Willie Nelson, Bruce Springsteen, and over a dozen more. Music critic Milo Miles has a review.
What is rock and roll? Well, it's been a long time since I rock and roll. Been a long time since I did this roll. Let me get you back, let me get you back, let me get you back. Baby, where I come from. Been a long time, baby, a long time. A long, 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 long time.
Jerry Lee Lewis's Last Man Standing includes a photo of the so-called Million Dollar Quartet. This was Lewis, Johnny Cash, Carl Perkins, and Elvis Presley, who ran into each other in late 1956 at Sun Studios and recorded an enjoyable but not phenomenal sing-along jam session. Lewis was a newbie, and Presley was the king of rock and roll at the time, but there's never been any question who Jerry Lee considered the number one performer of the group. And if it seems indelicate for him to underscore his outlasting the rest, it's worth remembering that in 1982, after Elvis was gone, Lewis, Cash, and Perkins recorded a tepid collaboration called The Survivors. So you have to grant the killer this. During his hard partying and gun-waving periods, you would bet he would be the first man lying down. But at age 71, he has released his first album in a decade and his best in at least twice that long. Even more remarkable, Last Man Standing consists of 21 duets, yet it's not like most duet albums. Usually duet albums prop up an aging, weakened performer or display he's still a master of the game, but they inevitably try to expand his audience by attracting younger fans of the duet partners. But when Kid Rock is the youngest duet partner, this is an oldster get-together. And on most tracks, Jerry Lee is so much in charge that the partners seem there to keep his juices pumping. Last Man Standing is exactly like other duet albums, however, in that it's uneven and nobody will agree which cuts work and which don't.
Come on, Killer.
Well, now you may think I'm fooling for the foolish things I do. You may wonder how come I love you when you get on my nerves like you do. Well, baby, you know you bug me. Ain't no secret about that. But come on over here and love me, baby. I'll show you where it's at.
For me, Led Zeppelin's Rock and Roll sounds as tailored for Lewis as Bruce Springsteen's Pink Cadillac. Buddy Guy, John Fogerty, and Neil Young are on fire, while Willie Nelson, Merle Haggard, and Don Henley are damp and dozy. Kid Rock is so hammy he should come in a can. But what matters more is that Lewis's darting live-wire piano boogie and his reflective down-home trills are there whenever he needs them. And projecting his unstoppable, rakish personality as much as his voice, he makes rock, blues, country, and pop into Jerry Lee Lewis tunes one more time.
Now don't be ashamed of your age.
Lord, no.
Son, don't let the years get you down.
Oh, boy.
That old gang you knew, they still think of you.
I want it.
As a rounder in your old hometown.
I hear you, Jerry.
Now don't mind the gray in your hair. Just think about all the fun you had putting it there.
Yeah, boy.
As far as that old book of time, you've never skipped a page. But don't be ashamed of your age, Mr. George Jones.
I hear you, Jim.
Don't be ashamed of your age.
It's a bit surprising that Last Man Standing hasn't gotten more attention. Lewis obviously ignored the wise Johnny Cash tactic of persistently recording and releasing material in order to keep on people's minds. But even so, Lewis is too dark and demented, too much a fallen preacher to become sainted like Cash. And as he would be the first to say, he doesn't give a flip. His closing duet with Kris Kristofferson, The Pilgrim, is an inspired choice. Lewis isn't a perfect match for the song's title character, but they share a wild, rambling spirit, and the tune delivers his most enduring message. It is good to be the killer.
But if this world keeps right on turning, for the better or the worse, it only ever gets older and around. From the rocking of the cradle to the rolling of the hearse, the going up was worth coming down. He's a poet. He's a picker. He's a prophet.
He's a liar.
He's a pilgrim and a preacher. And a problem when he's stoned. He's a walking contradiction.
Partly truth,
partly fiction.
Taking every wrong direction on his lonely way back home. There's a lot of wrong direction on your lonesome way back home.
From the rocking of the cradle to the rolling of the hearse, the going up was worth the coming down.
Milo Miles reviewed Jerry Lee Lewis's album of duets called Last Man Standing. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
I can tell, by the way, you're a little bit lost. Just like Jerry Lee, things will be someone that you're needing to forget. Honey, that's the same thing with me. I've been wondering, baby, why don't we just make believe it ain't the first time we have met.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of The Skin Type Solution, a revolutionary guide to your best skin ever by Dr. Leslie Bauman. From the Broad Foundations, encouraging entrepreneurship for the public good in education, science, and the arts at broadfoundation.org. And from the Cato Charitable Foundation, advancing environmental values and saluting all those who work to sustain our world. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Zev Chaffetz discusses his new book, A Match Made in Heaven, about the alliance between Christian Zionists and Israelis. Chaffetz was the founding editor of the Jerusalem Report and directed the government press office under Prime Minister Menachem Begin. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.